You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comic books. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is the first half of my 2008 interview with Alan Moore, concentrating on his graphic novel, Lost Girls. Lost Girls began as a serialised comic in the fifth issue of the adult periodical Taboo in 1991. Most of the strips in Taboo were horror and were illustrated in this sort of edgy, monochromatic style by S. Clay Wilson, Steve Bissett. But your strip with Melinda was far more, you know, full colour in a fully illustrated style. I mean, was that a conscious attempt to do something different to the rest of the content? Or did the publishers approach you with, they wanted that kind of material?
Well, I think that what happened, as far as I can remember, the early days of Taboo, Steve Bissett was getting an anthology magazine together. And I'd done a little story with Bill Ray, who I believe did a lot of work on Ren and Stimpy, from okay. what I hear. But I'd done one for the first issue, and then when I was thinking about From Hell with Eddie Campbell, we decided to serialise that, starting from, I think, the second issue or something like that.
Yeah.
And when I began to think about doing work with Melinda, this was, it was actually not connected with Taboo. There was another publication that was supposed to be coming out over here that was called, I think, Lost Horizons of Shangri-La.
Okay.
And was supposed to be an erotic anthology. Mm-hmm. And they'd approached both me and Melinda separately to do an 8-page piece for it. And Melinda had been writing and drawing her own work for years. Over there on the West Coast.
Right.
But I am a bit like a Dalek in that I am immensely powerful but can't really go upstairs. You know, it's sort of, I have to have an artist that I can work like a glove puppet.
Yeah.
And sort of, in order to get anything done in comics. But I'd wanted to use Melinda as an artist because I'd been a huge fan of hers for decades, and Neil Gaiman, I think, put us in touch with each other, and she came up to Northampton for a couple of weekends, and we were just talking about what we did and did not want to do with erotic comics. I mean, once I'd seen Melinda's colour artwork, which I hadn't seen before that point, I realised that this had probably got to be in colour. We started to knock ideas back and forward, and when we arrived at the idea of Dorothy, Wendy and Alice, we realised that this was probably going to be a much bigger story than the 8 or 16 page original
Indeed.
Inclusion in this anthology, which fell by the wayside anyway.
Yeah.
But by that time I started to think that Taboo is the title of Steve Bissett's magazine, and after talking to him at that time, he said that he'd meant that to be all inclusive
and not just horror.
Not just horror. So I thought, well, why don't we try putting Lost Girls in there as a stark contrast? And we ran it in there for 3 or 4 episodes. I can't really remember now.
I think it was 5 chapters over 3 issues.
Yeah, and it took us, I mean, we went through 3 publishers in the course, at least 3, in the course of doing Lost Girls. They were just dropping like flies all around us. This wasn't a direct cause and effect relationship with them publishing Lost Girls. It was forces in the industry, things like that. But we had an awful lot of publishers just kind of collapse under us.
Right.
And for a number of years, it was me financing the continuation on it, just because it was something that had to be finished, you know. And that situation went on. I knew that somebody would pick it up eventually, because it was looking like such a wonderful piece of work. And but then Chris Starros stepped admirably into the breach, and it's been relatively plain sailing ever since.
Well, the things, I mean, if Taboo had continued indefinitely and you'd done a couple of chapters, say, every 6 months, it would have taken about 7.5 years to produce the whole comic. But in fact, it's taken twice that long.
I mean, has that kind of been a blessing that it's given the two of you a lot longer to kind of refine them into the version you ultimately wanted?
I think that, Taboo, it didn't last very long, and that was because, not because necessarily of just of Lost Girls, but a lot of the other people, it took them a long time to do the work as well. And I think that, I mean, if we'd known back then that it was going to take us 16 years or whatever it took us, I like to think that we'd still have gone for it, because it was such a good idea, and we wanted to be the first people to do it. And so, and in a way, it's turned out very well, the fact that it has taken 16 years, because eerily enough, if we'd left it any longer, or if we'd finished it a little earlier, if we'd finished it a little earlier, there would not yet have been the reproduction techniques that would have been capable of reproducing Melinda's artwork with the kind of fidelity that we see in the Top Shelf volume. If we'd left it any longer, there would not have been the drums for actually photographing artwork of that size. I mean, hardly any comic artists these days work on Bristol board anymore. They mostly work on computer. I mean, I don't think that there are any more Brian Bolland originals. I don't think there have been for about 10 years, other than printouts. I know that Kevin works on board, Kevin O'Neill, and Melinda, but it's a rare thing, an increasingly rare thing. And it was very grueling for Melinda coming down here and bringing the artwork with her, for weeks, it seemed like, to get it photographed at a very nice little studio called Orange, where they had still got these old drums where you can actually photograph artwork of that size. But if we hadn't sort of fallen in that particular niche, it would have been a different story. So it's kind of, and also, if we'd have come out, say, 5-10 years earlier, under a Clinton administration, the world would not have been at peace, but it would have been relatively peaceful. And the fact that we are emerging at the, in the middle, well, charitably the middle, probably at the beginning of this Iraq bloodbath, the fact that that is happening, it makes the real stuff that Lost Girls is actually about a lot more important, a lot more pointed. I mean, like, because Lost Girls is very much pro the human sexual imagination, and it's also got a fairly heavy anti-war subtext. I mean, it is very much, as are me and Melinda, we're products of the 1960s, and I mean,
make
I remember,
love, not war.
Well, that was it. We said if we just bought ourselves a badge making machine 16 years ago, we could have saved ourselves a lot of trouble. You know.
Well, I mean, one of the other benefits of the Top Shelf version compared to the original version in Taboo is that, like you were saying, Melinda's colours seem a lot more vibrant in the new version, but also subtler at the same time. And also it's been relettered in the sense that you have different voices in the story, and they have different fonts representing each one.
To a certain degree, with the fonts, I mean, it's kind of, I think that the font that's used throughout in the dialogue was specially designed for Lost Girls by Melinda and our letterer, Todd Klein. And this font now exists. It's called T.K. Gebby. And sort of he just combined his initials with her name. Okay. And it was based upon, we looked at a lot of old Edwardian books, and we thought we didn't want something that was too fancy, because when you've got male characters talking, it would have looked perhaps a bit wrong, or would have given the wrong kind of intonations. But we thought with that one, it was a nice balance. It was kind of an Edwardian. It's got an Edwardian stiff upper lip to it, but it was quite delicate, quite feminine. So, and I mean, the main thing that we differentiated the characters with was the use of the motifs
The framing of the panels as well.
Yeah, the framing of the panels. I mean, like the, in all of these bits of Dorothy's Kansas history, you've just got these wide panoramic horizontal shots, you know.
Yeah.
And whereas for the Wendy sequences, it's very upright. It's like the bars of a Victorian park railing. Everything's very enclosed within these black borders.
Yeah.
Very repressed, you know. And for Alice, we've just got these kind of ellipses that have always generally got an image of reflection in them, you know. Just like the Dorothy ones have kind of, they've got their elements and their kind of colour scheme and approach. The Wendy ones have sort of generally got shadows all over them. The Alice ones have reflections. They were kind of motifs that we wanted to use for each of the girls, and of course their actual voices, the way that they talk.
Yeah,
you know, sort of. Yeah, I mean, it was very fully realised, the entire project. And I remember when we first approached Chris Starros, I remember him asking, how would you like to see this book produced? Which is entirely the wrong question to ask Melinda.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that was it. I mean, sort of, I mean, he perhaps swallowed hard when she said, yes, we would like it all like this, but he said, well, we'll see what we can do. The only thing that Chris wasn't able to do was that, and I think it was me who suggested this, I'd suggested that the book might be perfumed. And if he could have done it, then he would have done, but he said that there was no perfume where they were certain it wouldn't discolour the paper. So we went, he got some very old quality paper, which actually, to my mind, smells better than the finest Chanel. You know, you can really bury your face in Lost Girls, and it's such a great quality paper. It adds to the experience.
Yeah. You know? Well, I mean, I still get a fist on reading those old Titan reprints of 2000 AD. There's something about the ink they use that's, you know,
absolutely.
Really evocative.
Absolutely.
Another question about the going from a serialised comic to one that comes out as a sort of three-volume epic. Presumably that then means you don't have to worry about hitting sort of 6-month deadlines. You can think more about the complete work.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, like, when we originally structured Lost Girls, we were originally thinking, well, there isn't anywhere where we could bring out a work like this as a whole thing, and it would be best if we could finance it by making it episodic so that we could finance it as we went along.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know, the sort of, we originally thought that, well, there's a lot of foreign anthology magazines. Anthology magazines seems to be the main places that we could probably serialise this. So why don't we structure this so that it is in 8-page instalments, so that there are 10 instalments to a volume, and that there are 3 volumes. And that seemed to work. It gave us 240 pages. So it also kept it tight, because I'd noticed when I was doing Halo Jones for 2000 AD that there was something very good about having to deliver it in 5-page chapters, because you had to make each chapter perfect in itself so that it actually worked as a standalone thing. And that was good. That encouraged us to try and make each chapter of Lost Girls something that stood alone, that had got its own kind of special features or sort of its own approach, you know. And that, I think, yeah, we'd got the whole thing structured from the very beginning, but the kind of coloration of it, the tone of it, we were able to sort of keep that polished to a fairly fine luster all the way through by doing it in these small groups. And of course, yes, I mean, ultimately it was meant to be seen as a 3-volume book. So this is the way that it is from Top Shelf, is the way that it was always meant ultimately to be.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, doing a 300-page graphic novel with another person is obviously very much a labour of love, but in this sense it's both meanings of that phrase, because you and Melinda developed a relationship as it was going on.
Well, yeah.
I mean, as this interview is going out on Valentine's Day.
Oh, you know, well,
got to talk a bit about
a Valentine's message for everyone then. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd advise everybody to, for the good of their relationship, to actually embark upon a 16-year, very, very complex erotic project. It doesn't hurt, you know. I mean, like, although it's often occurred to me that actually Melinda and my relationship, the it's benefited immensely from Lost Girls, because from the very first discussions, even when we barely knew each other, we were sort of having to be very frank about what worked for us in terms of erotica and pornography. And there's a lot of relationships which can get to their bitter end without either partner having necessarily revealed as much about themselves as that. So that was how our relationship started, with kind of complete sort of sexual honesty and everything like that. And I think that as much as the book has helped the relationship, I think that the relationship has coloured the book. Because one of the things that was important to us was that Lost Girls, yes, it should be beautiful, it should be colourful, it should be intelligent, but it should also be compassionate, it should be warm, it should be emotionally warm, which is a difficult thing to achieve in pornography.
Well, so much of it is just about the act and not the relationship.
Well, absolutely. I mean, like, and we, there was a difficult balance to actually, we realised that we had to have an awful lot of the act in there. But we decided, otherwise it's not going to work as pornography. So we decided to kind of ration it. In the first book, there is kind of something sexual every episode. And in the, and there's probably something mildly sexual on every page.
But whether it's sort of the shadows applying,
that's it,
the metatext and all that.
But sort of by the second book, we decided to sort of to gradually increase it, so that there's kind of, I mean, by the third book, it's every panel. There is something sexual in every panel. Because we thought that that's the way that a pornography should, if any genre should, should build up to a climax. You know, and that was...
well, particularly with using Rite of Spring, you know, as a pivotal moment.
Yeah, I mean, we got the three pivotal moments kind of worked out from the beginning, just from looking at the history of that period. And we thought, yeah, Rite of Spring, that'll be fun in all sorts of ways. That'll be tremendous. And then the episode at the end of book two, where you've got the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the emperor, not the archduke, not the contemporary band, sort of. But you see, I'm here. I can make modern references with the best of them.
That'll be in the Extraordinary Gentleman when you get to the end of the century.
but it's yeah, you know, we'd worked out, we'd heard about this island where it was tropical for a couple of, about, for a few weeks in the year. Although it's surrounded by snow-peaked mountains, there is this tropical island, apparently. And so we thought, all right, we'll set this kind of encounter between the girls there, intercutting with the assassination. And then at the end of the third book, you know, World War I. Those seem like emotionally charged moments to sort of to break the narrative, you know, and we were able to structure it, you know, perfectly.
Yeah,
it's sort of right from the start we knew pretty much what was going to be on every page, you know.
When it came to collaborating with Melinda as writer and artist, I mean, how much did you kind of influence each other's decisions? I mean, you talk about, you
absolutely
know, Dalek and glove puppet analogies.
Well, yeah, that is I mean, like, actually think about it, a Dalek wouldn't be very good with a glove puppet, because they've only got that sucker thing and then the egg whisk that fires lightning bolts or whatever, you know. But I mean, look, the way that it actually worked, it was probably one of the most intricate collaborations that I've ever done.
Right.
I mean, like, normally I tend to turn out these gigantic scripts that are like phone directories, and which actually crush the human spirit to even read, you know. And Melinda had been used to working as a writer artist. She'd never read a script before.
Right.
And so she found it a lot easier if I just did a rough thumbnail picture, which I was terribly embarrassed about, because they're really sloppy. I can't draw very well. But
I still have fond memories of Maxwell and Magic Hat.
Well, you know, I'm all right in my place, but sort of next to somebody like Melinda, yeah. You know, my talents are entirely lacking, you know. So, but I did very, very detailed thumbnails of all of the pages, and sometimes Melinda would change them a little bit, but sort of she would be working very closely to the thumbnails that I'd drawn. And in the other sense, the influence that Melinda had upon the writing was incredible. I mean, like, there wasn't a panel, a line of dialogue that I didn't try out on Melinda first.
Yeah.
This was one of the benefits of having both a man and a woman involved in the work, because we were able to come up with erotica that hopefully would appeal to both genders, that would appeal to different sexualities. You know, we tried to make it as universal as we could and as accepting as we could.
Yeah. I mean, the other project you collaborated with Melinda on was Cobweb in Tomorrow's Stories. I mean, in that, it was very much working in the genre of pulp fiction. And ironically, actually, in the introduction to Taboo 5, where Lost Girl starts, Douglas Winter is talking about the Phantom Lady as being a kind of like challenging erotic strip that he remembered from his youth.
Well, I mean, well, I suppose that with the ABC strips in general, I was trying to kind of harken back to archetypes, at least in the comic book sense, that no longer really seem to appear in comics, but which I'd always enjoyed.
Yeah.
And we thought of various things. I mean, I enjoyed like Kirby and Simon's Fighting American, so we had me and Jim Bakey doing the first American. You know, I enjoyed Herbie, and some of that went into Jack B. Quick that I did with Kevin Nolan. But I'd always kind of liked the idea of glamour strips. But they're always so, generally so empty and vacuous that they're not actually about anything other than the bosom of the heroine, you know. So we were thinking, well, surely you could kind of use a kind of, pretty much a cipher, just a sort of an icon like the Phantom Lady, like some of those kind of sexy, diaphanous 1940s comic heroines. But you could actually probably do something quite funny, quite clever, a bit experimental. And I think that Cobweb was probably about the most experimental, outside of perhaps Promethea. I think that Cobweb was about the most experimental and perhaps the most flexible of all of the ABC strips. We had a lot of fun with that. Even if we did get continually censored by the thieving robber barons at DC Comics. Sort of, you know, there was the collage episode that Melinda did, which we had to cover up with butterflies, which I thought was quite ironic, because that was, of course, what they put upon Jacob Epstein's statue of Oscar Wilde. They placed a butterfly over the genitalia, which Aleister Crowley later stole and turned up, I think, at the Savoy or somewhere, with a cloak on, which when he removed it, he was naked apart from
that butterfly.
This butterfly. And this was a moment when one of the women dancing there remarked, said to her partner, "Who's that man?" And her partner said, "Oh, that's Mr. Crowley. I expect he's being invisible."
Well, and now, I mean, the statue of Oscar Wilde outside Charing Cross Station, people keep on stealing his cigarette. I mean, I don't know what that says about our times.
Well, yeah, I remember that there was somebody who actually protested against that because of the inscription that some of us are lying in the gutters. Some of us are, we're all lying in the gutters, but some of us are looking at the stars. And there was this
which somebody seems particularly apt for today's, you know, celebrity obsessed culture.
Well, yeah, and they were saying, well, actually, that's not very nice, because like some people actually are lying in the gutters.
Yeah,
which I think they'd understood Oscar perhaps a little too quickly.
Yeah,
you know, but yeah, Cobweb was a great strip. We both enjoyed doing that, you know, and it was at the point where Oscar Zarate said, "Look, you better get back to Lost Girls. That's more important."
Yeah.
You're
having
Melinda,
too much fun.
Yeah, so that Melinda decided to get back and finish up Lost Girls, and we handed over Cobweb to, you know, people like Dame Darcy, who did a fantastic job on it.
Yeah, definitely. You know. I mean, it's interesting, some of the kind of suggestive black and white art that Melinda did for Cobweb is not dissimilar to the Venus and Tannhauser section in Lost Girls. Almost like that was her first pastiche, so she was still kind of experimenting with it.
Yeah, that's possible. You know, I mean, like, I mean, that was her first pastiche, and probably, I wouldn't want to say it was the easiest, but it was certainly nowhere near as demanding as the Franz von Bayros stuff at the end, which nearly drove her completely mental.
Right.
Just all of those delicate lace effects and sort of all the ornament and decoration everywhere. You know, no, I thought that she'd done a sterling job. I mean, that was why I decided to include the white book, because I wanted to actually show how good Melinda was at mimicking other artists' styles, you know, Egon Schiele. You know, it was... I wanted to give her a chance to show off a bit, because I didn't think that the black and white books that she'd mostly been in had really done her justice at all, you know.
In the second half of my interview with Alan, we're talking about the various other artists that Melinda pastiches in Lost Girls, as well as Alan's homages to writers such as Oscar Wilde in that graphic novel, P.G. Wodehouse and Jack Kerouac in The Black Dossier. We also discuss the importance of sex throughout Alan's writing career, from Miracle Man to Swamp Thing, whether he's angrier now than when he wrote for V for Vendetta, and what it was like to be portrayed as a superhero in The Simpsons. All that and more at www.panelborders.com. Thanks for listening.